Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
I'm Alva.
And I'm Stephen.
And on today's New Statesman podcast, we discuss the latest developments in the Green Seal lobbying scandal. And you ask us, what's happening in the Metro mayoral elections? The Green Seal lobbying scandal is rumbling on. The latest developments are that there are going to be a number of inquiries into what happened, but also the other stories that it touches on, including officials, senior civil servants, and their moonlighting. So there's been this story that's been revealed about Bill Crothers, a senior civil servant who worked on procurement, actually working as an advisor to Green Seal for 2 months when he was still in that job and about to leave Whitehall. It looks like a great many parts of the way that Westminster and our government is run are being touched by this story. Does that make it any more of a danger for this government? Alva, you were covering it this morning. What do you think?
Yeah, I think I haven't really made my mind up on this one, to be honest, because as you just outlined, as this story develops, it is simultaneously coming closer to the current government. So as you mentioned, Boris Johnson is actually on the front page of the Daily Mail today for intervening on behalf of the Saudi Crown Prince, having been lobbied by him, even though ultimately the thing that the Crown Prince was asking for wasn't granted. But, you know, there is a quite mild lobbying story by the Prime Minister this morning, and also there is a story about, or there's the revelation that Boris Johnson's deputy chief of staff retained part ownership of a company that advises foreign governments while in Number 10. She still, I mean, to this day, retains those shares. And so it's simultaneously coming closer and closer to the Conservative government, but it's also expanding wider and wider to incriminate or potentially incriminate a lot of civil servants or senior civil servants too. So I think it could kind of go either way. I actually think that the thing that's kind of politically difficult about this, or makes it possibly less interesting to cover, is really, I think, quite how bad this is for the civil service. It's only a tiny number of people so far, but a handful of senior civil servants who do have second jobs, or did at some stage have second jobs in the private sector alongside their work for the civil service. There's not actually any suggestion of any wrongdoing so far. And it seems to be the case that this was within the rules, but there is a question about those rules, and it makes the civil service, I think, in particular, look very bad, because this is a sort of different thing to politics, in that, I mean, most politicians, you know, certainly in a Westminster context, you have MPs and then you've ministers, and they are all to a degree powerful. I mean, the MPs aren't making laws, but they are all quite prominent and have a great deal of power and responsibility, and doubly so for ministers. Whereas I think the thing with the civil service is that, of course, there are very important civil servants working really at the heart of government in very senior positions, but there are thousands and thousands and thousands of civil servants working all across the UK, and often doing so for not, you know, not particularly brilliant salaries, and working in the public interest. And I think that it's so damaging for the civil service in general, to have some of its most senior members shown to be, you know, to have other jobs and to be potentially like profiting off that and not necessarily being entirely transparent. So I think it's really bad for the civil service, but that makes it sort of difficult to talk about politically, because the obviously Labour want to push the Tory sleaze angle, and this is very damning for politicians as well. But I am very, very struck today at quite how bad this is for the civil service too. There's not much you can do politically to make hay out of that. It's just very bad for public life if the civil service is brought into disrepute. But that's, I think, my main thought. But I'm interested in what the two of you think about this too, about whether this becomes a Tory sleaze story or just a general story about the political elite.
I was struck by how hard Keir Starmer went on it at PMQs yesterday. I thought he was really good, the way that he did try and frame it as a Tory sleaze scandal. That's quite a bold thing to do, because as you say, this kind of activity touches every party. And as we can see, it's touching a great number of people in politics and in Whitehall already. And often, you know, with things like this, you've seen it in the past with the expenses scandal, for example, but also other scandals like the amount of spending in individual constituencies during election time because of our sort of outdated election spending rules. Most parties don't like to go very hard on this stuff, because they know that if they looked in the mirror, then it wouldn't be a particularly flattering picture either. So I think it's bold of Keir Starmer to go on this, and perhaps he can see, like with the expenses scandal that broke, you know, at a time when there were more Labour MPs, so there were just more of their expenses that could be put under scrutiny. Perhaps he sees it as, okay, we've had over 10 years of Tory government. All right, this government isn't the same government as, you know, the one under David Cameron, but people do know that the same party has been in charge for all this time. And if you have, you know, what I think there are now 7 inquiries coming out of this. If you have a number of inquiries that are going to be asking about these questions, the most politically damaging stories are going to be the most recent ones in recent times, because, you know, that is far more visceral, and often the figures are likely to be around still. And David Cameron is still, you know, a very well-known public figure who's very active. So when you have those recent stories coming out in the inquiries that are upcoming, then it's more likely to touch the party of government in charge, even if it encompasses the civil service, as you say, and other parties too, and senior figures in previous governments that weren't Tory governments. So I think he's probably made the calculation that this could be particularly damaging for Boris Johnson's government, even if it's a wider story. So I was struck that he was bold enough to go down that line, which suggests to me that this is at that tipping point, this story, of tipping from, you know, that kind of malaise and complacency that we have about our politicians. You know, people, it's often baked into people's thinking about politicians. Politicians are very unpopular. People think, well, aren't they just doing all this anyway? Isn't that just par for the course? It's tipping over from that into something that is a little bit more shocking and is more distasteful, particularly in the context of a pandemic, you know, particularly in the context of this idea that friends of people high up in government have been trying to profit from the misery and the tragedy and the chaos of this time. I think we're reaching that point now. What do you think, Stephen? And I should warn our listeners, Stephen has been attempting to do his meeting sources outdoors today. So we may get some wind in the background as well.
Yeah, Laura Kay ain't got nothing on me. I'm told this is a regular feature of newscast, which I'm apparently stealing. I think the two ways that the scandal has changed is, one, as Alva says, it has widened to the senior civil service, but also I think more importantly, it's quite difficult to see how this scandal doesn't end with civil servants, yeah, so senior civil servants, having to have a similar register of interests of the kind we all have as members of the parliamentary, well, I say we, I mean Alva and I have as members of the parliamentary press gallery, where if we have additional money-making interests and come from our having the past, we have to declare that. There's a register of interests that you can see with every member of the parliamentary press gallery. And obviously MPs and ministers have a register of interests. Now, the reason why I think that will potentially be quite significant is, as Alva says, all of this is within the rules, but like the house flipping in the expenses scandal was within the rules. The, you know, like, most of the stuff which made people really angry in the expenses scandal was, you know, was fine from a, you know, those people hadn't broken any expenses regulations, right? In some cases, they've been explicitly told, hey, look, here's a thing that you should do to compensate for your additional costs. And I think, therefore, there will probably be many more headlines of this type, of which I just think, yeah, I just think generally it's quite hard if you're the government of the day to escape some blame from that. Because, like, we've talked about this before, right? The reason why, the kind of various arguments about government cronyism became acute in the middle of the pandemic is the government's pandemic response was not going well. And I just think it's so unlikely that at the end of this, there won't be three or four examples of, you know, something that the government didn't do that well, or like a business which went bust, or a loan that shouldn't have been lent to, where there is a disclosure about proximity between the civil service and the private sector that is not uncomfortable for the government.
Yeah, no, I think that's true, definitely. And also you do... There is a tipping point for all of this, even if, as you say, you know, most of it is technically allowed. The morality of it and the gap between the ordinary person reading these stories and what our leaders can get away with eventually does start to chafe. I remember I interviewed David Dimbleby last year, and he was talking about sort of significant moments where he felt like public opinion was changing during episodes of Question Time. And one of the stories that he told me was about Margaret Beckett, and it was during the expenses scandal, and she'd used some of her expenses for something, I can't remember what it was, but it was something like hanging flower pots or something minor outside her constituency house. And one of the audience members asked her whether she would give that money back, and she said no, because, you know, it was within the rules. And David Dimbleby just remembered the audience was absolutely furious, and he was like, that's when I knew, you know, that was a big burst of outrage. And of course, as we saw of how that story developed, you know, we still kind of have the ramifications today in terms of how unpopular our politicians are and how it's so difficult for them to gain people's trust. Even popular politicians, you know, don't rate particularly highly. So I think this could be one of those moments. I mean, it depends, I suppose, on the mood, the public mood, but there has been a great deal of dissatisfaction with some of the response to the pandemic by the government. And while there is going to be this vaccine bounce, and while there is some optimism with each of the devolved nations opening up a little bit more and a little bit more towards summer, if stories like this rumble on, they are going, you know, you can see at the moment it's filling the vacuum of news at the moment, particularly following the death of Prince Philip, when the news agenda went quite quiet. You can see that when there is a vacuum of news like during summer, something like this can take hold and can dictate the agenda. And there's so many businesses that have suffered. There's so many people who've lost their jobs. What do they feel when they're reading about these, about people lobbying on behalf of businesses that have gone bust, or having, you know, the phone number of a particular minister who could help them out? How are they feeling when they read this stuff? I mean, it will be useful to get out and about and do some more reporting on the ground. But I wouldn't be surprised if this is one of those moments that David Dimbleby was describing to me when I spoke to him.
I think my view is that it really, I think, depends on what the next stories are, so stating the obvious there, I suppose. But I mean, I think I'm repeating myself when I really emphasize how vast I think this story is. But I mean, it in a way, it isn't meaningfully one story anymore, in that we're getting a lot of reporting on the themes of lobbying and double jobbing and conflicts of interest, which go quite far beyond the original story. And I think that, I mean, so on Stephen's point, you know, I think it is likely that civil servants and advisors will have to declare their interests in a more transparent way, and that there could be still some more scandal around that. But I think it's probably, you know, it's worth noting that we already have a register of interests for politicians, like, you know, the kind that Stephen mentioned for the two of us and all the members of the press in Parliament. And the thing about that is that, you know, it means that most of our politicians' interests and potential conflicts of interest are matters of public record. And they're therefore not that shocking to people, because there's a sort of a feeling that once these things are declared and they're transparent, then they're completely fine. Politicians do have interests elsewhere that are just on the record, and then people don't really know what to do with them. You can't expose them if they're already sitting there. And so really it's only civil servants where there isn't a need to declare in the same way, where there's a more scope for scandal in that regard. So I think in terms of conflicts of interest, there isn't that much further that this can go, because there have been plenty of conflict of interest scandals in the past or potential ones, and they just don't really, they don't resonate with that many people. I think that it's lobbying where this story could have legs that are damaging for the government, because I think people do inherently find it a bit shocking that, you know, that someone is able to just text, you know, that you're able to text Rishi or you know, take Matt Hancock for a drink. You know, it's completely right and proper that businesses and groups and individuals and charities and people from all walks of life in the UK should try to put their case and advocate for themselves to government. But most people aren't able to text Rishi Sunak to make that case. And I think maybe like that kind of core is the thing that will most surprise people, or that story I mentioned about Boris Johnson being lobbied by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. I think, you know, if there are more stories like that that come even closer to the current government, that's where this could be potentially the most scandalous, as well as the actual. And then I suppose the third thing is the deeper problems around the access that Greenhill Capital was given to government during the Cameron era. And I think, you know, the question there then, I mean, I suppose that's the heart of the Greensill scandal, the actual use of supply chain finance in government and the access that Lex Greensill personally was given. I think that, you know, so the core of the story is quite controversial. Definitely, I think it's already not looking great for David Cameron. Can't see how it looks any better. But then how it touches the current government, I think it really rests on more developments that specifically touch the key characters in this government.
The thing still about this story, though, right, is it, I think at its heart, the thing which is damaging is simple, right? One, as Alva says, this idea that, well, you know, my business, which lost out X number of things during the coronavirus crisis, didn't have the chancellor's number, right? It's that kind of stuff. It's the, you know, it's not what you know, it's who you know. But I think actually the biggest single problem that all of this creates for this government is that it imperils the very successful rebranding of it as a new enterprise in the summer of 2019. Because this is fundamentally a story about old relationships, right? It links back the shiny new chancellor to the tattered old prime minister. It links the sitting prime minister to the government, and he's kind of like etch-a-sketched himself out of. And what is the big strategic imperative of a lot of things Labour have said about this government since Keir Starmer has actually been the word old, right? This is an old government. This is a government that's been in power for more than 11 years. It'll be in power for 14 years. And I think any story which
which, if this makes sense, brings the world of the 2010 Conservative Party closer to the world of the 2021 Conservative Party, is kind of bad in a sort of kind of weird way that no one sort of notices. But the big success of 2019 was they were able to be the change proposition. And I think one of the problems this story has is it draws into focus both the not being a change proposition in a kind of like, oh, you know, politicians up to their old tricks kind of way, which is double-edged for Labour, of course. But also just in a kind of very obvious way, and it goes, hey, look, these are the same people.
And it's funny that we've seen, we saw yesterday in all of the debates about this in the House of Commons, the Conservative strategy at the moment really does seem to be this kind of, gosh, did you hear about this Greensill scandal? Isn't that terrible? Did you hear about that David Cameron? Awful business. Shocking. And I mean, I think probably in the short term, that's reasonably successful. We saw so many Conservative MPs standing up saying that yesterday or things to that effect. But I think that maybe there's just a limit to how much you can do that in the longer term, because I don't see, or it would be an amazing political sleight of hand to maintain that shape-shifting that Stephen just described, that people really seem to view Boris Johnson's Conservatives as a totally different party to David Cameron's Conservatives. But you do have to wonder, and that this is a genuinely open question, I'm really not sure whether it'll work or not, but you do just think that, you know, taking chunks out of David Cameron, the former Conservative Prime Minister, as the Conservative Party, you do just sort of wonder, you know, how that won't just damage the Conservative brand overall eventually.
Yeah. I think that is the key question, isn't it? Whether or not people will begin to associate this government with the days of Cameron. And, you know, having Boris Johnson in Parliament talking about Dave and is not really going to help him. While people know that, you know, the people at the top of this government are quite removed from those days, I don't think that's necessarily obvious to the public as well. There are lots of pictures of David Cameron and Boris Johnson together during the time when David Cameron was Prime Minister and Boris Johnson was London Mayor. I think there is an association there. You know, they went to the same school. They're two very recognisable Conservative politicians of recent times. I think it's optimistic for this government to think that it necessarily can carry on being seen as something new.
If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
So our question today is from Jacob Millen Bamford. Thanks for writing in. He's asking, what's going on in the West Midlands mayoral race? And we thought we'd use this as an opportunity to talk about the Metro Mayors, who will be being elected on the 6th of May. So London will be having its sixth mayoral election, and then there's six other regions who are about to hold their second, and West Yorkshire will be about to choose its first mayor. So shall we start on the West Midlands, because that was the theme of the question? There's been a bit of mayhem in Liam Byrne, the Labour candidate's campaign. It seems that he's lost some of his staff who were supposed to be working on the campaign, and that some of his parliamentary staff have been working on it instead. There's been a few reports trickling out about that. Does that suggest that Labour isn't in the best shape to win that election, which it so narrowly lost in 2017, Stephen?
Yeah, I think it does. And I think it speaks to the weirdest thing about these Metro Mayor elections, which is actually how little attention Labour has paid to them, not just over the last 18 months, but basically actually going all the way back to January 2020 when most of the candidates for these vacant roles were selected, which is they were selected sufficiently late and they weren't able to address the Labour Party conference in 2019. Unlike, you know, Sean Bailey got a better slot at Conservative Party conference than any of the incumbent Labour mayors, let alone any of the challengers. And the new leadership has been slightly more interested in these races than the one which came before, but not like a lot more, up to and including the weirdness that, considering when these were last fought, they got 27% of the vote nationwide in the May 2017 local election. So if you think about even the worst polls for the Labour Party now, even if you have optimistic accounts of what the incumbents' personal ratings will be, right? The ability of Andy Street, Ben Houchin, et cetera, to isolate themselves from the National Party brand and to do better than the National Party. These are all contests which really ought to be very much in reach, just from a mathematical perspective, right? Labour ought to be able to, with a little bit of resourcing, you know, the right campaign, get over the line in these contests. Now, of course, that could still happen because, yeah, like the Labour Party could do quite badly and still be gaining quite a lot of votes on May 2017. But it does, I think, speak to the underlying weirdness of Labour's approach to these races, which I think is true of all of them in different ways, which is a kind of weird lack of interest. The candidates are obviously quite interested in them, but the party as a whole never seemed to be that fussed by the Metro mayors.
And I think I would add on the West Midlands mayoralty, while we're on it, is I think quite how confident the Conservatives are of keeping that one. I think it's the perverse impact of the kind of the disaster of a campaign that Sean Bailey has been having in London is that I don't think that there are, I mean, feel free to write in if you can find examples, but I don't think that there are any London Conservatives or Conservatives who live vaguely near London who are campaigning for Sean Bailey. They're all in the West Midlands campaigning for Andy Street to keep his place as West Midlands mayor. I think they're kind of, it's quite an easy call. I mean, why would you not do that if you looked at Sean Bailey's race and saw quite how badly that's going? But I think they're all reasonably confident, which should tell you, you know, from Labour's perspective, I don't think that they, I don't think their chances are that good in the West Midlands this time.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because sort of some of the wisdom about Metro mayors is that personalities can run for these positions, and people use the example of Ken Livingstone and Boris Johnson and Sadiq Khan and Andy Burnham in Manchester. But actually, there's an interesting piece for Centre for Cities that John Elledge, who used to work for us, has written, which shows that actually Sadiq Khan and Andy Burnham are the only two mayors at the moment who have more than 50% of people actually know is their mayor. And then the rest of them, you know, people are giving wrong answers or just don't know and weren't even aware that their city had a mayor. So it's interesting from that perspective, because that does suggest that name recognition hasn't cut through, even in places where, you know, the Tories have been championing their mayor, like in the West Midlands with Andy Street. So it will be interesting to see whether or not that kind of name recognition and that kind of star quality that Andy Burnham has, you know, been trying to amass for himself since taking the position, and particularly sort of in his standoff with the government over the restrictions last year. And, you know, there were Conservative Metro mayors who were also public about their concerns about not being consulted about sort of which parts of the country would be put into which tier, etc. It'll be interesting to see whether any of that has any manifestation in the election results, or whether that kind of complacency or that lack of interest even that you were describing does have an impact on Labour's showing. The West Midlands is an interesting example as well, because it's that toss-up between whether or not this is going to be a truly post-Brexit election in which people are going to vote on sort of policy issues and, you know, transport infrastructure. And there's been a lot of job losses in the West Midlands. It's a very young region, and we know that young people have been hit by unemployment the hardest during the pandemic. Will people be voting on those kind of societal issues rather than voting the way that, you know, those five West Midlands constituencies did in 2019 when they switched from Labour to the Conservatives. So it'll be interesting to see whether those changes to, you know, what people have described as Labour heartlands, although lots of West Midlands seats were marginals. It will be interesting to see whether those changes over the years since Brexit are bedded in and are going to endure, or whether or not people will sort of their loyalties will flip back, or whether they will express their dissatisfaction with the way that their region or their city is run in a different way, in a less predictable way, or whether or not that pattern of certain areas drifting from Labour to the Conservatives is going to be a permanent one, or not permanent, but a long-term one.
Yeah, and I think to drift sort of seamlessly from the West Midlands to the Tees Valley, I do think one of the fascinating things we see actually across pretty much all of the incumbent metro mayors is how having the perception here in London that you have done well and then you have a huge personal brand is actually, it turns out, more important, sadly, than whether or not that's actually true, right? We see that in different ways, right? Why is Sean Bailey the mayoral candidate for the Conservatives in London? Because broadly, no serious Conservative looked at Sadiq's numbers in 2018 when they selected and thought, yeah, I fancy that. They went, why would I waste 2 years of my life being beaten by Sadiq Khan? Why is actually Labour has selected quite a good candidate, I think, in the Tees Valley, and a candidate in Liam Byrne who, yeah, has a great CV and does meet the challenge of Labour appearing to take the result seriously in a way that, with the greatest of respect to Sean Simon, you know, someone whose highest sort of career was being a junior minister and an MEP, just did not reflect the seriousness of that role. But yeah, it's sort of an accepted truth around here being Westminster, that, you know, Ben Houchin has done really well, and this is the important and, that voters know about it. Now, that is a bit true when you're like on the ground in the Tees Valley, right? You will meet people who are, you know, shall I say, civically engaged, who have picked up on the fact he's done well. But I'm not convinced there are that many. Yeah, then there are lots of MPs in London who, if you go to like the Friends of the Local Library Society or some other civically engaged group of people, they'll go, my MP's great or my MP's terrible. And obviously that is important, but it doesn't actually move a significantly large number of votes other than in very close elections. But the perception and the number of people in any given seat who feel that way exist is much larger than it is, I think, is one reason why the Labour Party hasn't resourced Tees Valley as well as it could have done. Yeah, kind of, it's one of those things where even the most sort of resolutely anti-Labour or anti-Keir Starmer talking head would now accept the idea that the Tees Valley remaining Conservative is more of a reflection on Ben Houchin than it is on anything in national politics, which I think will be true, because the belief that that's the case will be why he didn't have a properly resourced challenger. But I just think if you just look at it on the face of the constituencies, what we know about the extent to which incumbent mayors do or do not have a proper footprint, particularly in these circumstances, is not really actually true.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Chakelian, and my colleagues Stephen Bush and Alva Ray. We're produced by Chris Stone, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. If you want to leave us a question for the You Ask Us section, email in podcasts@newstatesman.co.uk. Please leave us a review and don't forget to subscribe. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned, We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.